From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Democrats in Washington are eager to pass a sweeping bill to expand voter rights across the country. But today, it appears their prospects are darkening in the U.S. Senate. Democratic leadership is hoping they can convince West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin to vote yes in support of the For the People Act so that every Democrat is on board. They're going to need that party unity because every single Republican is expected to reject the bill. Joining us now is ABC News political director Rick Klein, who is, of course, watching this story very closely. Rick, welcome.
Great to be with you.
Great to hear you. Now, you've written that this showdown has been a half a year, maybe decades even, in the making. How so? What do you mean by that?
Well, what we're seeing now is the Democrats bringing to a head a long-running complaint, concern around Republican obstructionism, in their view. And this is Biden and Schumer against McConnell. They're foes that know each other well. All year, we've been talking about election reforms in the states, and this is priority one, literally the first bill numbered by the House and the Senate, H.R. 1, S.1, the ceremonial title, the top priority for Democrats. And they're using it now to bring to a head their concerns and complaints about the use of the filibuster. They know that this is going to fail. Even if all the Democrats agree, it's not going to advance because no Republicans will join them. But they're hoping to use this as a powerful example for why this needs to change.
Well, President Biden met with Senator Manchin yesterday. He also met with the Arizona Democrat Kyrsten Sinema, who wrote an essay in The Washington Post today that's explaining why she wants to keep the filibuster rule in place. And of course, that requires 60 votes to pass any legislation. It requires bipartisanship in this makeup of the Senate. And she's making the point, Rick, that Republicans, once they're in power, would just undo everything that Democrats might pass with a simple majority. And even watching politics for many years in Washington, does she have a point? Would that happen?
Sure. I think there's a very good chance of that. I mean, look, the concern is based on the fact that the talking points seem to trade sides when the majority trade sides. It's either a naked power grab or it's unimpeded obstructionism, depending on what side you're on. And for senators that have been around a while, they get a little bit weary of it. Now, they will engage in finger pointing forever about who started it and who's made it worse. I've seen both parties change the rules or threaten to change the rules as it benefits them. But you have a handful of Democrats, Manchin and Sinema are the two that are public, but there are others who privately feel like there is a reason to need to strive toward bipartisanship, and there should be some kind of safeguard for that. Some Democrats feel like the rules have been abused by Republicans, but they don't have their own party on board for this right now. And Manchin and Sinema could not be more clear. They have no intention of changing these rules, and that's one of the arguments that they use is that, hey, look, anything we do with 50, well, there's going to be 50 on the other side at some point in the future.
Yeah, and so without Sinema and Manchin willing to budge on the filibuster, I think it's safe to say that this bill, the voting rights bill, it's not going anywhere. In fact, many other bills won't be going anywhere either, will they?
I think you could see the Democrats coming to the limits of what they're able to do with that 50-50 Senate and the very narrow majority in the House. We saw the failure a few weeks ago of the January 6th commission bill. There will be other items that come up, maybe infrastructure, maybe voting rights. And the bottom line is you're going to need some degree of bipartisanship on all of them. That's the message that this sends. And I think for a lot of Democrats, it's going to be frustrating, but it is a consequence of divided government. They barely have these majorities, and they're doing what they can, and there's only so much they can get done.
Do you think voters will mind in the midterms? I'm just wondering, what does this mean for the president's agenda if, the Democrats try to go to voters in the fall and they haven't been able to get much done?
Yeah, there's going to be competing narratives around this. The Democrats will say, look, the Republicans blocked us. You need to elect more Democrats. The Republicans will say we did what we could to hold the line and we'll be energized for the midterms. They will take that case to the voters. Of course, you never settle arguments like this, but a lot of this is geared toward midterm politics where you have to assume Republicans have a built-in advantage. They do very well in a midterm with the opposite party of the sitting president. But the arguments about who's responsible for the gridlock in Washington could be powerful ones. And I think that's where the rubber hits the road for Democrats this week.
All right. Rick Klein, ABC News political director. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
When defensive lineman Carl Nassib of the Las Vegas Raiders came out on his Instagram yesterday, he talked about the importance of supporting young people who identify as LGBTQ.
I actually hope that one day videos like this and the whole coming out process are just not necessary. But until then, you know, I'm going to do my best and do my part to cultivate a culture that's accepting, that's compassionate. And I'm going to start by donating $100,000 to the Trevor Project.
Joining us now from the Trevor Project is Amit Paley, CEO and Executive Director of the nonprofit, which is focused on suicide prevention. Amit, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. Carl's coming out is significant for the NFL. He's 28 years old and the first active player to come out as gay. What does this mean for you?
It means a lot. I mean, I was born in the 80s, and growing up in the 80s and 90s, there were not that many role models of people that were out. I mean, I remember when Ellen DeGeneres came out, and it was such a significant moment. I was not yet out, and there was huge backlash. That also coincidentally is the year that the Trevor Project was founded. So to go from a period, which isn't that long ago, in 1998, where someone like Ellen DeGeneres coming out for a period of time ruined her career and faced with a lot of backlash and lack of acceptance, to someone like Carl coming out and getting this huge amount of support, I think it does show that huge amount of progress. It's inspiring and it's meaningful, I think, to young people in a very profound way.
You know, it occurred to me that the response to Carl's announcement is somewhat different than what we saw with Michael Sam, who was an All-American defensive lineman at the University of Missouri, who announced he was gay before being chosen by the Rams. We're talking just a few short years ago. Have you seen this change and shift in the way that society is accepting these types of announcements in different ways that we haven't before?
I think we're definitely seeing changes in society, and that there is, in many different parts of society, more acceptance and support for LGBTQ people. And I think it's really important that we recognize that that is not uniformly true, and that there are still many parts of society where there is a lack of acceptance for LGBTQ people, and specifically for some identities within the LGBTQ community. And here I'm particularly talking about transgender and non-binary young people. This is Pride Month, and this is such an exciting and important announcement. And at the same time, we have states across this country that are trying to attack LGBTQ young people. And we have politicians that are trying to prevent transgender young people from being able to participate in sports. So I think this is an incredibly important moment that we should celebrate and look at the progress that has been made, and also recognize how much more progress there is still to go.
This donation from Carl, it's $100,000. What impact will it have on your organization?
It's going to have a huge impact on our organization. This has been a very, very difficult year for LGBTQ young people. COVID-19 has cut off many sources of support. We've had many LGBTQ young people who've been trapped in homes with families that are unsupportive, or in some cases, physically and emotionally abusive. And we've had all these political attacks on LGBTQ young people. So this donation is going to allow us to expand our life-saving programs for LGBTQ youth and make sure we can send a clear message to them that they are not alone and they always have somewhere they can reach out to for help.
Nassib said in his video that one day he hopes that videos like the one he did won't be needed anymore. And that's the world you're trying to create.
That is the world we're trying to create, and I also hope for that. I thought it was such a beautiful message that he put out, because he really, in the message, tried to center and focus on the needs of LGBTQ youth. And I think we all pray for a day where it's not news that someone is truthful and open about who they are. It's not news that people are being accepted. It's not news that people succeed in all walks of life, regardless of their sexual orientation or gender identity. We're not there yet, and we have a lot of work that we need everyone to do to get there, but I believe in the arc of the moral universe bending towards justice, and I think one day we can hopefully get there where announcements like this are not news at all.
Amit Paley is the CEO and Executive Director of the Trevor Project, a nonprofit that is focused on suicide prevention for LGBTQ youth. Amit, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And and we want to catch up on a story you might have missed recently. At the graduation ceremony at Wilberforce University in Ohio, school president Alfred Anthony Pinker dropped some pretty big news on the graduating class.
The Wilberforce University Board of Trustees has authorized me to forgive any debt.
Yeah, I'd be cheering too. The historically black college wiped out more than $375,000 of debt for 167 students in the class of 2020 and 2021. Dr. Pinkard joins us now. Thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, thank you for the invitation.
And it's been a couple of weeks now, but we're really glad to have you because we could just, you know, we could hear the joy that you brought to your students when they heard that news there. Explain why it was important for your school to do this.
It was a wonderful moment, as you noted. And we know that student debt is burdensome for all students as they begin life post the undergraduate experience. And so at Wilberforce, we felt that this was an incredible opportunity with the confluence of just saying thank you and how proud we were of our students. And I think it's important to note that I had neither the authority nor the resources to forgive all student debt, that is debt owed to banks or to the federal government. But the little bit that we were able to do, I think, was most appreciated by our students and their families. And so we were very, very happy to give them that gift at that moment.
So what is included? Fees, tuition, balances that were paid directly to the university by the students or their parents?
That's right.
Right. How did you do that? Where'd the money come from?
One of the organizations that helped us, and I'd like to shout out the Jack and Jill that came forth and indicated that they wanted to assist us in this endeavor. We had scholarships that were available to us. We are a member of UNCF, which is a consortium of 37 schools. Your audience may know it. It's the United Negro College Fund's time-honored organization that's been around for 75 years, assisting students and their pathway to an undergraduate degree. And so a combination of that allowed us to take a look and see what we could do. Our CFO really sort of ran the numbers, and it was apparent that we were able to do this. And so we were very excited about it. We kept it under wraps, and it was purposeful that we made the announcement at commencement. That's how we were able to do it.
Well, you know, big picture, Dr. Pinker, the numbers paint a pretty clear picture here, right? Black college students take out over twice as much money in student loans as white college students. What's the impact of a disparity like that? And then also of you being able to wipe that away for some people?
Well, you're absolutely right. Black students bear an onerous burden for student debt. In fact, 95% of our students are Pell eligible, which means that they come from family incomes below a threshold that then qualifies them for federal financial aid assistance. And so to the extent that an institution like Wilberforce can come forth and say, we recognize the burden of this debt. So again, one part of it is forgiving the debt. Of course, the second part of it is for a student to use that forgiveness in a way that gives them a little bit more room as they are getting their after Wilberforce and other undergraduate institutions.
Well, hold on there for just a minute, Dr. Pinkard, because I want to bring in one of your former students who knows exactly what you're talking about. Cleopatra Melton is here with us now. Cleopatra, are you there? How are you doing?
Fine. I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. So I'm just guessing that you were one of those students erupting into cheers when that news came down that your debt was getting wiped out.
Absolutely. I chose to watch it virtually from home, but I was absolutely dancing, shouting, crying. It was as if I was there. It's unbelievable. And I didn't get a chance to formally thank Dr. Pinker, but I just want to thank you, Dr. Pinker. I want to thank your faculty and staff. I want to thank everyone at Wilberforce because it wasn't for the faint at heart. It was a lot of trials and tribulations, ups and downs, long nights, early mornings. But we did it. And I don't take it lightly, the opportunities that Wilberforce and your faculty has afforded me. Thank you.
You're more than welcome. And it's for that very experience that you just described that we were happy that we were able to do that for you, to acknowledge the work and persistence and resilience that you and your fellow graduates have shown. So it's been my honor and pleasure to do that.
Well, it's my pleasure to have both of you here together, talking together. Cleopatra, just tell me, first of all, what did you study and how much debt were you planning to walk away with when you graduated?
My degree is a Bachelor of Science in Organizational Management. And I can say that I was already in debt. I came from a junior college. It was Cuyahoga Community College, and Tri-C has a pathway to Wilberforce, meaning you do 3 years at Tri-C and get your associates, and then you'll only have to do 1 year, hopefully, at a university. And Wilberforce was one of the pathways, and they absolutely accepted all my credits. And so I already had an insurmountable amount of debt from my junior college. And so what Wilberforce did is they wiped off a considerable amount of tuition and cost that would have compounded what it was already there. And that's what I could
thousands
say on that.
Thousands and thousands of dollars?
Several thousands and thousands of dollars.
Yeah. So yeah. In the context here is that, you know, you're, from what I know about you, you're a non-traditional student. You're 46 years old, a single mother, two kids, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this has got to be a pretty big deal. And I could hear it in your voice there when you were talking to Dr. Pinkert. I mean, how much will this help you and your family?
It will help me a lot because I had my children so young. But as I started to see their dreams being realized with their degrees and them doing well and situated in their own lifestyles, I then took it upon myself to go ahead and try and make sure that my dreams and my parents' dreams were realized. And it's kind of bittersweet that I was able to do it with one of my parents being able to be there physically and watch my voyage. But unfortunately, my mother, who I precede in death, she wasn't able to. She was always with me spiritually. She kept me going. And the ancestors that Dr. Pinkert spoke about in his speech at the graduation ceremony, you know, they helped us to push us through and make it happen. So, you know, you just can't give up because you never know who you're impacting. You know, our children look for us for all kinds of guidance. So then when they watched me get my first degree, they then said, well, if you can get your associate's, mom, surely you can get your bachelor's. And that's exactly what I did. Got my associate's. I graduated cum laude, and then I went on to get my my bachelor's, and my grade point average was 3.88, which is right along with being a summa cum laude. So, yeah, that's just how
it is. Look at you. I love it. So, Cleopatra, you still do have debt. What's your plan to pay that off now? And I guess I just wonder, like, if you're feeling lightened about the future, if you're feeling more optimistic about the future now that you have less than you expected.
Well, that's a great question. I absolutely do feel lightened to some degree. It's a workable amount now. Also, I wanted to make note that throughout my voyage, the faculty and staff was so incredible. My experience was so incredible that I always said, I want to come back and teach at Wilberforce. And they said, you can't do it with just your bachelor's, Ms. Melton. You have to go and get that master's. So that's what I plan to do, is get that master's, because I want to come back and pay it forward to girls like myself who started so young with their children. I want to look in their eyes and tell them, if I can do it at my age, it's never too late. And so I am going to go ahead and pursue my master's in 2022. Haven't picked out the school just yet, but I definitely am going to pursue it. I'm going to get it, and I'm going to come back, and I'm going to pay it forward to this university.
Well, you know, we are rooting for you. We are definitely rooting for you. And Dr. Pinkert, you in the school, you did a very generous thing here. But I guess the question is, now what? I mean, what about the students who come after Cleopatra?
Yeah, that's a legitimate question that we've been asked. My response is, I don't want to overpromise and underdeliver on that. It's my hope that there are other philanthropists who hear this story, who are moved by the story, who are moved by the incredible story that Ms. Melton has just provided us, and her passion and her interest in creating a wonderful life for herself and her family. If they can come forth and partner with Wilberforce, we certainly welcome that. And this will give us an opportunity to perhaps do this next year and the following year and the following year. But right now, irresponsible of me to suggest that next year we're going to do this, because clearly this requires significant funding in place. We're happy that we were able to do it for this class and last year's class, and hope that there will be partners that will join with Wilberforce to make it possible for subsequent classes as well.
Well, and Cleopatra, I'm going to give you the last word here, because your school isn't the only one doing this. We know that Delaware State University recently announced that it's using COVID relief money to forgive student debt. Morehouse graduates had their debt forgiven a couple of years ago by a wealthy graduate. You know, as someone who has received this benefit, what kind of broad statement do you think these examples are making as we see more and more of them?
I will say that my prayer is that it becomes the standard and not the exception, because as I was, you know, soaking it in and just been enamored in this moment, I have friends, I have family, and even children that did not get the same blessing. And so I just would hope that each one teach one, you know, if it could be a domino effect. I don't know the ins and outs of financials and making it happen. I just pray that one day, that, again, that this is not the exception, but the standard across the board. So I'm glad that, you know, Wilberforce was able to start the conversation, but it doesn't need to end here.
Absolutely.
Wilberforce University President Alfred Anthony Pinkard and former student Cleopatra Melton, thank you very much for speaking with me. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you for having us.
NPR's No Compromise podcast just won the Pulitzer Prize. We explore a breed of gun rights activism that's online, organized, and unwilling to budge. I'm Chris Haxel.
I'm Lisa Hagen. Check out No Compromise wherever you get your podcasts.
With more states legalizing marijuana, a lot of pot-sniffing police dogs are getting sent off to an early retirement. At the same time, there's new demand for dogs trained to sniff out the smell a human body gives off when it's fighting COVID-19. Kathy Carter from member station WUSF takes us to a Florida hospital to meet a 2-year-old Labrador retriever who is a very good girl.
When visitors enter the lobby of Doctors Hospital in Sarasota, Florida, they're greeted by Buffy, a friendly yellow lab sporting a work vest, along with her handler, hospital employee Grace Wellsby.
What she's going to do is I'm going to walk her by you. She's going to sniff at your feet. If you do have COVID, she will lay down. If not, she's just going to walk on by, okay?
Okay.
Buffy gives a quick smell and promptly walks away, which signals the visitor is COVID-free. Buffy has been on the job since April. She was trained at Southeastern Guide Dogs in nearby Palmetto. The company specializes in service dogs to help disabled veterans and people with vision loss. But scent detection is something new for them. Training dogs for this purpose required actual samples of the virus. Those were collected by swabbing the saliva of consenting patients with COVID-19. Bob Mead, the CEO of Doctors Hospital, says the volunteer samples were then heated and deactivated to make them non-infectious.
We went through several months of figuring out, you know, not only from a logistical perspective, but all the legal requirements and, you know, how patients would feel about donating a sample for this, also keeping it safe.
Buffy and several other dogs were trained to recognize the chemicals in the saliva of the patients with coronavirus. One of the methods used was exposing the animals to competing scents like cinnamon and mint. Titus Herman, CEO of Southeastern Guide Dogs, says after several months, Buffy was able to detect COVID-19 with 95% accuracy.
These dogs have about 6 million scent cells in their noses, which is about 6 or 7 times that of humans. They can detect scents even while they're exhaling.
Buffy caught a whiff of the virus on a visitor during her first week at the hospital. Her handler says it only took seconds for the dog to recognize the scent.
I know that someone has COVID when she won't get up after laying down unless I wave a treat in front of her face.
Early research indicates positive results with scent detection programs in Thailand, the UK, and Germany. The hope is to deploy virus-sniffing dogs to public spaces. A bill in the U.S. Senate would direct the TSA to study using dogs to screen for the virus at airports. And Titus Herman at Southeastern Guide Dogs says canine scent detection could also benefit people long-term. The organization plans to train dogs to detect stress hormones for veterans suffering from PTSD.
So what we're going to be asking some of our veterans is to send us a T-shirt that they wore during the night when they had a panic attack. And we will then train the dogs to detect that veteran's specific chemicals so that they can alert the veteran before they actually happen.
Back at Doctors Hospital, there's a brief lull in activity, and Buffy is doling out a little pet therapy to hospital employees.
Buffy!
Hi!
Oh, she's so sweet. Thank you for the kisses.
But when a new group of visitors walks through the doors of the hospital, Buffy and her sensitive snout get back to work.
Okay, Buffy, search. Good girl. She did not detect COVID on you.
That is a good thing.
And a lot less painful than a nasal swab. For Here and Now, I'm Kathy Carter.
It's often called a second holiday rush, a manufactured push known as Amazon Prime Day, where consumers can get special deals on the site, raking in billions of dollars in sales for Amazon over just 2 days. But this pandemic year reveals some of the problems for workers rushing to fulfill those orders in the midst of continued supply chain issues. Eugene Kim is chief tech correspondent for Business Insider, and he joins us now. He writes about Amazon. Welcome.
Hi, how's it going?
Great. Well, what is different now post-pandemic? How is Amazon dealing with supply chain issues that we know have affected all kinds of goods in recent months?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons why Amazon changed the date of this year's Prime Day from July to June is because of these supply chain issues, right? A lot of sellers are dealing with, you know, shipment delays, factory shutdowns, labor shortages. So there's the added challenge on top of having to compete with other retailers.
Right. And this pandemic year has also brought about a change in our spending habits, right? Many people are reliant on online shopping. So perhaps that also changes the calculation?
Yeah. And I think in some ways it's good for Amazon because more people are shopping online. And while Amazon doesn't share any numbers around Prime Day, you know, Wall Street expects anywhere between 7 to 12 billion in sales during this 2-day event. And just for context, you know, Amazon had $108 billion in first quarter sales. So that's almost 10% of last quarter's sales in just 2 days, which is pretty remarkable.
Hmm. You mentioned Jeff Bezos pushing Amazon Prime Day earlier this year. This was a big part of the reason why, because of these supply chain issues.
Well, I mean, Amazon never really specifically explained why, but I think transportation constraints was also one of the reasons.
Those challenges to workers, Will Evans at Reveal has reported that injury rates among Amazon warehouse workers go up around Prime Day. What does it mean for workers that Amazon has basically created this rush in the middle of the year?
Well, a lot of warehouse workers, they're put under a lot more pressure during this whole week. For example, they can't put in any time off requests during Prime Day. Amazon basically blocked it. You know, a lot of these issues are basically opening up politicians and activists to use this as an opportunity to bash Amazon in some ways. And, you know, just for example, yesterday, right, Mayor de Blasio said Prime Day is the day not to shop on Amazon because of these labor issues. And, you know, I've heard of a number of protests taking place today, even in front of Jeff Bezos's house in D.C. You know, it's a all-hands-on-deck situation for the warehouse workers, but it's also for Amazon itself. It's kind of a bad publicity event in some ways.
Hmm. There's also an issue for third-party sellers. We often forget that Amazon is a marketplace. They've complained about Prime Day. What does it mean for them? Does Amazon make them offer sales? And do those sales eat that cost?
Yeah. So they have to, if they want to offer specific kind of Prime Day deals, they have to reach a requirement in discounts they offer. And given all the supply chain issues and the cost increases during the pandemic, there's concerns about the quality of special promotions these sellers could offer this year. Some of the sellers I talked to said they're not planning to participate in this year's Prime Day because of these cost concerns and, you know, shipping delays. And that could really affect how many people shop on Amazon during Prime Day, you know, maybe lead the shoppers to go on competitor sites.
Right. Speaking of competitor sites, they're trying to get the attention of consumers, as you say. Walmart and other big box stores are offering their own sales. Are other retailers making any headway against Amazon with those sales, or is it just something that they have to deal with because Amazon takes up so much oxygen in the marketplace?
Yeah, I think it's both. Prime Day just became this shopping holiday of its own, right? Every Amazon competitor, including Walmart, Target, they started offering their own special deals day. You know, now I'm seeing even like small business owners who may not necessarily sell on Amazon having to offer 2-day, you know, 1-day special promotions right around Prime Day just to meet the demand.
That's Eugene Kim, Chief Tech Correspondent for Business Insider. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And there's news today about another tech giant. Europe's top antitrust agency is formally investigating Google. The European Commission is looking into allegations that Google is abusing its dominant position in online advertising technology, a business that takes in more than $147 billion a year. The BBC's Theo Leggett joins us now via Skype from London. Hi, Theo.
Hi, Tanya.
A few weeks ago, we spoke to you about a $270 million settlement Google paid to French regulators over some of these same issues. This is a more wide-ranging case, isn't it? What exactly are regulators looking to do?
It is a lot of the same ground, in fact. Now, as you know, the way in which advertising is bought and sold on the internet is quite sophisticated. The software used by people who are buying advertising, the software used by people who are selling advertising, and there are ad exchanges in the middle, one of which is run by Google and which Google is accused of favoring in the way it sells its advertising. That's part of it. And that's what the French authorities were very upset about. And that's what Google settled for, as you say, $270 million. But what Brussels is also interested in is how Google makes use of data about internet users and how it uses that information itself, but does not necessarily pass on that data to third-party suppliers. So this is quite a wide-ranging look at how Google operates its advertising model, how it operates the different parts of its technology platforms, and whether or not it's using its dominant position in that market to favor its own products and services over those of other people.
How has Google responded to these allegations?
Well, Google has said quite simply that it's working with the European Commission and will be very happy to answer any of its questions. You have to remember that this is not an accusation as such. This is the European Commission deciding that there are grounds on which to investigate. But it's not said that Google's guilty of anything. It's not put any formal charges. That would come further down the line. But this is, if you like, the latest skirmish in a series of battles between Google and the European Commission. Over the years, Google has been fined something like $9 billion by the European Commission for breaches of competition law and for what the European Commission would say is an abuse of its dominant position. So this has to be seen in that wider context. On the other hand, you know, Google hasn't exactly come out fighting here. It hasn't said that the European Commission is deeply wrong or that it's being vindictive or anything like that. It's simply said it's willing to work with the Commission. And this is the same kind of tone we saw, I think, in its dealings with the French competition authorities. It's a bit more constructive and perhaps a bit more collegiate than what we've seen in the past.
I mean, you know, Google's parent company, Alphabet, is worth more than $1.6 trillion. It's hard for us to wrap our heads around that kind of dollar amount. Is there any amount of financial penalty that could really make a dent?
I don't think so. Not really. As you say, Alphabet and Google's profits are phenomenally high, and it's unlikely that any amount of fines from the European Commission would make a sizable dent in that, not even the $9 billion or so in fines that have already been imposed by the European Commission. But nevertheless, this is something that the US tech giants, not just Google, could do without. They've had a very contentious relationship with Europe's competition authorities in the past. It's not just Google, it's also Facebook, it's also Apple, it's also Amazon. So perhaps what we're seeing here from Google is a willingness to compromise, because it's not just the fines, it's the time, it's the effort, it's the demands made by the European Union are perhaps something that the company could do without. And it might feel now it's better off working with Europe's competition authorities than working against them. That is my interpretation, but it does seem that we've had something of a change of tone over the past couple of years.
That's the BBC's Theo Leggett in London. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
Voters in New York City are casting ballots in the mayoral primary today, and the winner of the Democratic primary is pretty much guaranteed to be the city's next leader, taking on a very challenging job at an uncertain time. Fair to say it's been a rough and tumble campaign so far. The city is using ranked choice voting for the first time, so it may be weeks before the final results are known. David Friedlander is a New York Magazine contributor. He's been following this race. David, welcome.
Great to be here.
And I'm just looking at the headline on this New York Magazine story that you wrote yesterday, calling it a berserk end of the campaign. Where do things stand now as New Yorkers go to the polls today?
It's been kind of a wild ending. Eric Adams, the Brooklyn Borough president, who's sort of running as a kind of centrist, tough on crime, pro-business mayor, he has sort of, you know, received, if not endorsements, at least kind words from Republicans, including former Mayor Rudy Giuliani. He's in the lead. Really, he has a strong support and a base in sort of working class Black and Latino communities in New York City. Behind him, there are about three candidates that are all bunched up, including Maya Wiley, who is a civil rights lawyer, MSNBC commentator, former Bill de Blasio, Mayor Bill de Blasio administration lawyer. She's sort of bringing up the left flank of the city. And then between those sort of two polls or two candidates, Andrew Yang, the former presidential contender, and Catherine Garcia, who is a former sanitation chief and has held a bunch of other jobs in city government.
And the issue here, and one of the reasons why this has been described as a berserk end of the campaign, is that Andrew Yang and Catherine Garcia have formed a loose kind of alliance in the final days of this campaign. And that has prompted Eric Adams, the front runner, as you say, of accusing them of trying to keep a black man out of City Hall. Can you just briefly explain what this is all about and how this turn in the races is going over with voters?
It's all kind of a lot, right? Because by merely competing, of course, and Eric Adams is black, they're all trying to keep a black man out of City Hall because they all want to put themselves in City Hall. But this is the first time that the city has had ranked choice voting, which means that New Yorkers will not just vote for the person they think will be the best mayor, but they will put five names down on their ballot and rank them in the order of preference. And one way in which experts say you can kind of get an RCV advantage is by trying to form alliances with other candidates. And that's kind of what Catherine Garcia and Andrew Yang did. They've been campaigning together through the weekend. Yang has a fervent group of supporters. Garcia was going to those supporters and saying, I want to be your number two. And Andrew Yang was saying, you should rank her number two if you support me. Garcia wasn't quite as explicitly asking her supporters to rank Yang. In fact, she refused to divulge who her number two choice would be. But they were campaigning together. They're on campaign lit together. I think this sort of inference was clear. And so Eric Adams, who frequently, when he's in a sort of tough spot, accuses his opponents of racism or bigotry or ganging up on him, he said that that was what was going on here and that they were sort of disenfranchising black voters by doing this.
So whoever wins, what kind of job is ahead? Because this has been a difficult year or so for New York City, and this is not the same New York that the current mayor, Bill de Blasio, inherited back in 2014. The issue of public safety and violence has been front and center. Emerging from the pandemic is on people's minds. What's ahead?
This really does feel like a kind of epoch-defining mayoral race in a way. So we're going to sort of decide the city's future and what kind of era the city will be entering into. Crime is up. We have lagged compared to other big cities in economic recovery. We still haven't fully recovered from the coronavirus. You know, the city was really kind of just kind of going along on fumes at times over the past 8 or 10 years as people just came to the city in droves, business boomed. That era is over, and we are in this big hole, and it really remains to be seen how and even if we get out of it.
One of the reasons that we're interested in this race is that New York is, of course, the largest and arguably the most influential city in the country. I mean, what do you think this race has to say about the state of Democratic politics across the board?
Well, I think in a lot of ways, it's sort of similar to the debates that you're happening in Democratic politics all across the country. I mean, in many ways, Eric Adams is sort of a Joe Biden. You know, he's very popular in communities of color. He's very popular among non-college voters. He's kind of a center-left, even moderate guy. And I think there's a question among Democratic Party voters about how enthusiastic they are, you know, for a kind of unapologetic left-wing agenda that Maya Wiley has, even in this, the sort of most democratic of cities. And then I also think that when you look at, you know, Andrew Yang had a sort of new theory of politics in a way. He had no ties, zero ties to New York City politics or government, had never even voted in a municipal election. And his campaign was sort of based on the idea that you can just kind of win an election on the internet. And I think we have to see whether or not, like, that paradigm still holds.
Voters in New York City are at the polls today. David Friedlander is a contributor for New York Magazine. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.